From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. What makes for a satisfying round of golf? Challenging, well-maintained courses with extras like ball cleaners, clubhouses with room for corporate tournaments, or is it simply cheap rates? Salt Lake City leaders are trying to give golfers what they want while figuring out how to pay for it all. The city's 9 public courses make enough money to stay afloat without tax dollars, but they need a $22 million infusion of cash to fix old irrigation systems and spruce up clubhouses. Should the city boost green fees to help foot the bill? Today on the program, the business side of Salt Lake City golf courses, plus the mandate for bilingual ballots. We check in with state and Salt Lake County election officials about translating voter information into Spanish. All that on your calls after the news. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Mark Twain famously said golf is a good walk spoiled, but there are plenty of folks who are looking for more than just a day in the sun. They want groomed courses, clearly marked holes, tidy restrooms, and decent food options. And like all savvy consumers, they want all of that at an affordable price. Salt Lake City operates 9 golf courses, and city leaders are considering to bump up green fees over the next 5 years to help maintain the courses. Joining me now to talk about keeping Salt Lake City's golf courses afloat and cared for, David Terry. He's the Golf Enterprise Fund Manager for Salt Lake City, and he joins me in studio. David, thanks so much for your time.
Good to be with you, Jennifer. Thank you.
Also, Thomas Wright is chair of Salt Lake City's Golf Advisory Board. He's also a member of a special golf task force, and he joins me by phone from Park City. And Thomas, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Later on in the program, accommodating the Spanish-speaking voter in Salt Lake County. But first, golfing in the city. Do you support boosting fees to pay for course improvements, or are higher green fees at public courses a turnoff? 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. David Terry, I want to start with you. The underlying fact in this entire discussion is that the city golf courses need help. They need better irrigation. They need new restrooms just to stay competitive. And city leaders are arguing that in order to keep viable, they need new clubhouses to accommodate tournaments. From the city's perspective, what are the most critical needs that golf courses in the city are facing today?
Well, without a doubt, Jennifer, the priorities are a number of projects related to using water more efficiently. That includes some new irrigation systems at Bonneville, Nibley Park, and major renovations at Rose Park. And also developing wherever possible secondary water sources, whatever those might be. And we're working with public utilities on those, whether it's wells, stream rights, whatever the case might be, so that we can potentially, at some golf courses, completely avoid using treated water. Those are the priorities. And you know, a significant part of our annual enterprise fund budget is directly related to water. Water costs $1.2 million right now is our annual tab. And if we can significantly reduce that water cost, putting conservation and being green on our greens aside for a second, then that allows us to potentially fund a lot of the other improvements that are necessary just to provide the facilities to compete with all the other public golf courses in the area.
I'm looking at a list of the capital improvement priorities that you've got, and you've identified about $20 million in capital improvements. What are the options for paying for these?
Well, we have an obligation as an enterprise fund to avoid using tax dollars, and we are completely committed to that, as is the city council and the mayor's office. And so when we look at how to fund these, we've got really two options. We've got financing associated with some type of a bond. But then again, that goes back to our operational budget. How much of a debt service can we afford annually? And then it's looking at green fees, looking to our golfers to help us generate the money. And there is a third, and that is partnerships. And we are pursuing partnerships out in the community, donations, corporate partnerships, and also with educational institutions to combine together to help us generate that money.
Okay, well, let's talk about the fee option first.
Okay.
So Salt Lake City Council is asking the public, hey, what do you think about paying a little bit more on your end for the ticket?
Right.
Describe, you know, how this fee increase would affect green fees right now. Because I understand right now the fees range from $26 to $30 for 18 holes on the courses in the city. How would this fee change that?
Yeah, there are two components to this potential green fee increase, which will be discussed at a public hearing tomorrow night by City Council. The public's welcome to make comments at 7 o'clock at the City County Building, third floor. Two components. One is the implementation of a new dedicated CIP fee, Capital Improvement Project fee, which the City Council is considering to be $1 per nine-hole round at every golf course. So again, if you play 18 holes, that would equate to $2. That's the CIP fee portion. We also, to keep things afloat, are also proposing to implement a variable operational fee increase as well. Now that ranges anywhere from zero at a couple of the golf courses up to $1.50 at Mountaindale and Bonneville, along with the CIP fee, again, to keep ourselves self-sufficient as an enterprise fund. So that's a quick summary of the potential fee increases that we're looking at. So again, that totals $1 plus $1.50 at Bonneville and Mountaindale. That's $2.50 per nine holes. Again, at our smaller golf courses, Nibley, Forestdale, and also Rose Park, we're looking at just that dollar CIP fee per nine.
Okay. David Terry, he's the Golf Enterprise Fund Manager for Salt Lake City. Also with us, Thomas Wright. He's chair of Salt Lake City's Golf Advisory Board. And Thomas, what do you make of the proposal to raise fees for golfers?
Well, nobody wants to see a fee increase for golfers. Everybody wants to keep golf as affordable as possible for the residents of the city and people that play the city golf courses. But unfortunately, the can's been kicked down the road for about 30 years on a lot of maintenance projects that just really can't wait anymore. I mean, you've got an irrigation system at Bonneville that I think, Dave, is 75 or 80 years old. Correct me if I'm wrong. And it's just band-aided together. I mean, it's barely hanging on, and it's pouring out culinary water that's been treated inefficiently. The wind blows it all over the place. The course doesn't look great as a result. And just, I think, a water study that was commissioned by Dave and our group showed that there was just a massive waste of water, of culinary water. So, I mean, this is a lot less about having a beautiful clubhouse so golfers have a posh place to go, and more about having functional bathrooms on the golf course, having functional irrigation systems, making sure that the golf course's perimeters are secure, making sure that the golf courses are functioning correctly. And like I said, it's been, many, many years of deferred maintenance that have brought us to this point. And we've come up with a lot of creative solutions. Our advisory board, along with Dave and others in the golf community, to come up with creative ways of financing these deferred maintenance projects. But at the end of the day, there's just really no other way. After having worked on this for 7 years, I can tell you that this is one of our last remaining options, is to gather a small fee on every round played so we can start to put some money into these deferred maintenance projects. Because you're just really not that far away from an irrigation problem at Bonneville where the whole course dies. Hmm. I mean, that's not far-fetched at this point. And so I think it's important that we categorize this as a deferred maintenance effort that really has to do with maintaining the course and not about building posh amenities for golfers on city courses. That's not what this is about at all.
Now, the fear, of course, is that higher fees are going to turn away customers. So, yes, people are going to be, you know, digging into their wallets and paying a little bit more, but there are going to be fewer of them. So are you really going to be able to make money on this? David Terry.
Well, that's certainly a concern, and it's a valid concern. And you know, in our projections relative to the potential fees, we've looked at some scenarios based on various levels of play reduction. Our responsibility and our we are committed to making sure that we provide an experience that is still a good value to the golfer. That's what we've got to do. We've got to increase the level of service. As great of a job as our maintenance crews do with what we've given them, we've got to do even better so that the public, when they come to one of our golf courses, they say, yes, I was treated well and I had a great golf experience. That's got to be our focus.
When was the last time the city increased green fees? And what kind of fallout did you see? Was there any?
Yeah, very little, and that was 2 years ago. And that was basically, you know, with a couple of minor variations, it was basically a dollar per nine-hole round. And prior to that, there was not an across-the-board increase for 6 years, which is highly unusual if you look back at history. It really is about every other year, every 2 years. And as we project forward, you know, I 100% agree with Thomas on really everything he said. He's been a great asset to us on our golf advisory board. We want to keep golf affordable, we've also been given the directive that this is a self-sustaining enterprise fund. So looking forward, you know, what we're going to see fee increases approximately every 2 years. There's just no way getting around it. And really, I think that's what the golfers are going to see throughout the market. Obviously, we've got to take a look at every other public golf course that we compete against. And, you know, we're really going out on a limb here on this one. You know, we have no idea what Salt Lake County will do with their green fees, what the golf courses in Davis County will do. But as Thomas said, we're to the point where we cannot wait on these capital improvement projects, the top priority issues. And so, like I say, it is a bit of a leap here, but we hope the golfers will understand that this is all about giving them the kind of experience long term that they want.
We're speaking with David Terry, Golf Enterprise Fund Manager for Salt Lake City, also Thomas Wright, Chair of the Salt Lake City Golf Advisory Board, and we're talking about a proposal to raise golf fees. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255 if you'd like to join us. Now, Salt Lake City has been in the golf business for at least 75 years or so. I mean, it's been a long time, decades and decades. I guess just generally from both of you, I'd like to hear, what is the public interest in operating golf courses anyway? David Terry, you talk a lot about competition from different public courses as well as private courses. How do you explain why Salt Lake City is in this business? David Terry,
thanks.
First?
Yeah, I appreciate that opportunity. You know, in some regards, golf has a stereotype that is about as far away from the reality of what we are providing as can be. You know, it's the rich man's game. That's the stereotype. As I look out my window and as I play golf on our golf courses, it's for the working man and woman and their children. That's what this is. It's a recreational amenity that we want to keep affordable because it's a great recreational experience. It teaches not just children. It teaches everyone so many character traits that are valuable. And you know, we hear all the time of businessmen who, when they are considering a partnership, whatever that might be, a business relationship, if it makes some sense to get that person out on the golf course, they can learn so much about what kind of a person they're dealing with by how they handle themselves on the golf course. That's just one example. We believe that golf, it is not the stereotype country club. That's not what we're providing. We're providing a great recreational opportunity, and we want to do so at an affordable rate for the public.
Thomas Wright, is there a legitimate need for Salt Lake City, for a municipality, to be in the golf business?
I don't think there's a need, but I try to avoid looking at problems in this light because the reality of the situation is that we're pregnant. In other words, I mean, we have golf in Salt Lake City. We've got 9 courses. The city's operating the courses. They've decided to provide the service to the residents. And I guess that's a discussion for another time, and maybe we should have that discussion now about whether or not the city should be involved. But I think it does provide a valuable public service. It's something that the city has been in the business of for many years. And this discussion that we're having now really isn't about whether or not we should or shouldn't be in the business. It's about we are in the business and how are we going to keep our courses from becoming functionally obsolete, because that's what's happening. The city's not doing the citizens any favors by operating these courses and making these huge investments in golf. and then not maintaining the courses. And they need to step up to the plate, as unpopular as it is in an economy like this. We've got to figure out creative ways to create financing for these deferred maintenance projects that, like I said, have just been kicked down the road for 30, 20, or 30 years and are causing the courses to become functionally obsolete and are requiring now rate increases in order to fund past deferred maintenance projects. And there's got to be a more there's got to be a more responsible way to manage the courses, and that's what this fee is about. It's about getting a dollar per round into a fund that can then be used for maintenance projects. And I hated seeing the dollar. I hate seeing fee increases, but it really is necessary, because then we can pool these funds, and in 20 years, Salt Lake City golf courses, if they're still in that business and they decide that's what they want to do, then we won't be in the same situation that we're in right now. But to ignore the problem and even get into the debate of whether or not we should or shouldn't be, I think is irrelevant at this point, because we are in the business. Salt Lake City is in the golf business. They don't own, but they operate 9 different golf courses and own some of them.
Thomas Wright, chair of the Salt Lake City Golf Advisory Board. Also, David Terry is with us, the Golf Enterprise Fund Manager for Salt Lake City. And we're talking about Salt Lake City's golf courses, whether a green fee hike to pay for improvements is a good idea. Salt Lake City Council is holding a public hearing on the issue tomorrow night. If you've got questions or comments about golf fees in the city or in Salt Lake County, for that matter, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. We need to take a break, but we'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Today on the program, golfing in the city. Salt Lake City Mayor Ralph Becker is proposing bumping up green fees at the city's 9 courses, and the city council is holding a public hearing on the golf fee structure tomorrow night at City Hall. Would higher rates affect your golf game? And should Salt Lake City be in the golf business at all? 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. With us this hour, David Terry, the Golf Enterprise Fund Manager for Salt Lake City. Also with us by phone, Thomas Wright, Chair of the Salt Lake City Golf Advisory Board. And before the break, we were talking about this kind of philosophical, policy-related question. Should Salt Lake City be in the golf business? And David Terry, you had something you wanted to add.
Well, Thomas is exactly right in saying that we are in the business right now. And so, we have no choice but to make sure that we provide a quality product. There have been some comments, that the city shouldn't, and that these properties should be used for something else. I hope the public realizes that these golf courses are operating free of taxpayer subsidy. We get billed quarterly for any service we use from the city's general fund. If you pull golf course XYZ out of the mix and use it for a park or community gardens or whatever, that is not going to be a self-sufficient financially operation. And so, and the city is not in a position, and really no city right now is in a position to add any additional operating expense to their budget. And so I can understand where some people might come from that are not interested in playing golf when they look at an alternative use. But financially, this is a use that provides no tax burden to the citizens of Salt Lake City. And we're very proud that we really are one of the few public golf course operators in the state that really do operate a true enterprise fund, where we are paying for any material supply expense, including labor. It all comes out of our operating budget. The other element is, well, we hear, yeah, well, let's let a private operator operate these golf courses. The city has looked at that multiple times over the years, and they've determined that it really has never made sense. Traditionally, that ends up resulting in one of two, if not both, of the following: green fees go up, and many times the quality of the product goes down because now there's the profit element associated with a private operator running those golf courses. We have an incredible value in public golf, given our green fee structure combined with the quality of product, not just Salt Lake City, but throughout the state. Utah leads the nation, really, in the percentage of publicly owned golf courses. And the citizens understand that. And I think that with what we're doing here with Salt Lake City, with this CIP fee, we still are in that ballpark of operating these public golf courses at a very, very affordable rate. The other thing is we need to understand that this CIP fee, it doesn't solve our problem. It's really a small part of our overall funding that we need to generate.
I want to get to some of those other options out there for funding. But if you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Again, we're talking about golf in Salt Lake City. If you have questions or comments, we'd love to hear from you. So this isn't going to solve your problem. It's only going to raise a portion of the money. So where's the rest going to come from?
Thomas, do you want to jump in? Any comments on this?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of different funding options. Like David so eloquently said, the golf fund has to come up with the funds for any of these projects. So in other words, no taxpayer money is going to be put into the golf courses, which is a good thing. I support that. I think that's smart. I think it's a great system, but we've looked at different options for coming up with the financing. One of the ideas we came up with that doesn't look like it's going anywhere was to sell a couple of parcels of land on some of our golf courses to come up with financing, but that doesn't look like it's going to be very popular. So one of the things that we're looking at is bonding for the money. We can enter into a bonding relationship to come up with some financing, and there's some partnerships that we can evaluate too to come up with to try to come up with the close to $20 million we need on just deferred maintenance projects. And I think that's really the key I keep emphasizing is that these are projects that should have been done along the way that the golf courses are now stuck with in a down economy with revenues that barely meet their operating budget. And now how are you going to finance these $20 million worth of projects to keep the courses functional and to make sure that golf remains competitive in Salt Lake City and that the city doesn't end up with a huge burden of courses that can't generate the revenue to maintain their operations. And so I applaud Dave's efforts, and our committee has done everything we can in a creative way to try to come up with solutions. And really where we are right now is partnerships, coming up with creative partnerships to get money. One of them is with the University of Utah. The University of Utah golf team needs a place to go, and the University of Utah would like to have a place potentially to have golf clinics, and with the geography of Bonneville Golf Course being located close to the University of Utah, that's an option. And then doing some bonding and some other creative things to come up with the financing.
One of the comments that I saw several times in the Open City Hall online discussion is a plea to adjust fees for out-of-towners and just keep rates low for the city dwellers, saying, you know, this is a common practice in other public courses. Do you know, David Terry, what percentage of your patrons come from outside the city, and is this a feasible approach?
Well, we would be one of the few golf courses, public golf courses in the state, that if we were to implement a non-resident fee structure. Even St. George, which used to do that, no longer does that. They charge one rate for everyone, other than if in St. George, if people purchase a preloaded, almost like a debit card, then they get a lower rate, from a bulk investment up front. But basically less than half of our total rounds, and we're talking, the last few years we've been, around 450,000 nine-hole rounds of golf played among all of our golf courses. Less than half of those rounds are by Salt Lake City residents. And so we already rely heavily on people throughout the Valley and Davis County and even Utah County, Wasatch County, to provide the rounds required to keep these golf courses in the black. It's something we want to try to avoid. We don't want to disincentivize, non-Salt Lake City residents from choosing Salt Lake City golf courses. We need their their patronage.
Thomas Wright, what do you think of that idea, kind of shifting part of the financial burden onto to people who live outside of the city, the tourist tax, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, it's an option worth looking at for sure. Everything's on the table and everything should be considered because there's not a bad idea in this discussion. So it's a good one. But I think one of the challenges will be that the inventory for golf is just it is very high, higher than the demand. In Salt Lake City, there's 9 golf courses, and then there's surrounding county courses. There's a lot of places to play golf in Salt Lake County and in Davis County, even Summit and Wasatch, Tooele. I mean, there's places to play golf, and we have to be competitive with the other systems. And I think we're more competitive doing this fee increase that we're talking about right now across the board, a smaller fee increase for everyone, than we are doing a larger increase for tourists, because all they'll do is find our competitor courses that are more affordable and play those. But like I said, I mean, nothing is off the table, and Dave and I and the committee and everybody else that's been working on this, no idea is a bad idea. We want the public's comment. We want everybody to be heard, and it's definitely worth looking at, and I think it has been evaluated, but we view it as something that would be very risky at this juncture.
Thomas, you mentioned that there are plenty of options out there for golfers in this valley and throughout the state. So is 9 two courses, is that too many for the city to be operating?
I don't think it's too many. We've done well with them. We have great courses. But it's a challenge. I mean, it's a challenge with all the golf courses that were built in the last 10 or 15 years. There's obviously not being any being built right now, but there was a golf boom there for a while where everybody was building a golf course. And so that supply has made it increasingly hard in this economy to get people to the course and to remain competitive. But I think it gets back to the discussion that we talked about earlier is I guess I don't focus on whether 9 is too many or whether we should have 9, because we do have 9, and that's not going to change. We have to figure out how to make the 9 we have work, make the fees affordable for citizens, keep golf affordable for everybody, but then also make sure that the courses are being maintained so they're not depreciating even further in value and going to be a burden to the city at some point in the future.
Although you did advocate earlier that selling off slices of a golf course would be acceptable. So I guess the question is quantity over quality. And that is a comment that appeared over and over on the Open City Hall forum. David Terry, your take on that? Is closing a city course or two a realistic option? Is it cheaper to maintain 7 as opposed to 9 and just have real high upgrade maintenance on the ones that you've got?
Well, it's certainly something that needs to be considered and is being considered at the present time. We're having a discussion right now relative to the future of the Jordan River Par 3 golf course, which is located on Redwood Road adjacent to our Rose Park golf course. Internally within our golf fund, we subsidize the Jordan River Par 3. Again, internally, I'm speaking. And so we've got to take a look at the future of the Jordan River Par 3. And we've got to do the same thing throughout our system. That's something that the city council, that's a decision the city council will make. They have asked us to take a look at that. And again, as a first step, we're reviewing the future of the Par 3 course at Jordan River.
We're speaking with David Terry, Golf Enterprise Fund Manager for Salt Lake City. Also with us, Thomas Wright, Chair of the Salt Lake City Golf Advisory Board. We're talking about a plan to increase golf fees at the city's 9 courses. 801-355-TALK is our number if you would like to join us. The water issue is huge. And we live in a desert. Just policy-wise, how do we justify spending so much on irrigating these courses when water is such a prized commodity? Thomas Wright?
Well, I mean, it is paying for itself. In other words, I mean, the courses are able to afford the water that they need to function. And, you know, the purpose of the golf courses is not to create a profit. The city council made that abundantly clear to me when Rocky Anderson asked me to be on this committee, and the city council, confirmed that appointment, so to speak. They made it very clear to me that they wanted golf to remain affordable, that they did not want the fees to generate profits, quote unquote, that they wanted this to be basically a break-even venture. And it is. And the city courses are able to pay for the water that they're using. But David hit the nail on the head earlier, and I think I reconfirmed that it makes us a little queasy to watch culinary water, you know, treated water that we drink, being put on to the golf courses. And we've got to do a better job of using the water rights that we have, where we have streams and where we could drill wells and we could use secondary water sources. We should be exploring those. Unfortunately, that's going to require some capital, and that's part of the problem where we are right now, is we don't have that capital. So we've got to be creative. We've got to come up with some financing and some funding to start looking at secondary water sources so we can conserve the water that we have, because quite frankly, it does make me queasy when I see it, and it's irresponsible, it's not smart, and Salt Lake City deserves better. We're a green city. We pride ourselves on being progressive. We've got to do a better job of conserving the water resources that we have.
Now, this idea of boosting fees, again, just part of a solution. The first fee increase would occur January 1st, if approved. Is that right, David Terry?
That is correct, yes.
Okay, so how soon would people actually be able to see improvement on the course? If you're starting to get additional revenue in January, which probably is not a big golf month, when can golfers expect to see some improvement?
Yeah, and relative to the fee increase January 1, during the winter months, we provide various special rates to provide golfers with a good value during the winter when the golf courses aren't in their prime condition. So really you're looking before until March before we really start to generate this the profits from this $1 per round fee increase.
Will we see improvements this summer?
But yes, but one project is already online, and that is we were able to purchase some property at the end of the driving range at Rose Park. The driving range is too short at Rose Park, which is the same situation we have at a couple of our other golf courses. Projects that are included in this $20 million, although 33% of the $20 million, just under $7 million, is associated with irrigation. But we will be extending the driving range at Rose Park this summer. In fact, that project is out to bid right now. We will have, when the golfers show up at our courses this spring, we'll have a list of all the projects that are projected at each golf course. And we're going to, we got to take them one at a time, but we will start on some of those projects. We're already in the planning phase on many of those. The big ones are irrigation. Those are going to take some more time because the CIP fee is such a small portion of the funding. But things like restrooms, some other improvements, they are in the works already.
We only have a couple of minutes left, but I'd like to get your take on both of you playing the what-if game. So if the city council decides, an increase in green fees, not a good idea at this point in time. Thomas Wright, where should the city go from here?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, that would be a really...
I'm sorry, no. Thomas. We're you're cutting out on us. I apologize.
Oh, sorry. Can you hear me?
Okay, gotcha now.
Yeah, I don't want to apply any unnecessary pressure to the city council. I think they've done a great job in assessing this, and Mayor Becker as well. But that they, if this fee increase doesn't happen, they're putting the city courses in a very, very difficult situation. If we do collect this $1, the city courses collect this $1, we don't achieve $20 million of financing for so many years. I mean, this doesn't even scratch the surface. This is just a stopgap measure to at least start some of the things that we need to do to make the city courses competitive. So this is just one of many things that needs to happen. I just don't see how the city council would not approve this. I mean, the golf courses would just be in a perilous situation if they didn't.
David Terry?
Well, and I would just say that so far in the three meetings we've had with city council over the last 3 months on this issue, most everything we've heard from them is that they are supportive of the implementation of this CIP fee.
David Terry, Golf Enterprise Fund Manager for Salt Lake City, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Jennifer.
And Thomas Wright, Chair of Salt Lake City's Golf Advisory Board, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Up next, the mandate for Spanish voter information in Salt Lake County. But first, a break. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Bilingual ballots are coming to Salt Lake County. Joining me to outline what's in store for Spanish-speaking voters in the county, Sherry Swenson. She's the Salt Lake County Clerk, and she's in charge of elections in the county. And Sherry, thanks so much for your time today. Mark Thomas is with us as well. He is the Director of Elections for the state of Utah, and he's also the Deputy Chief of Staff to Lieutenant Governor Greg Bell. And Mark, thanks so much for your time today.
Good morning.
Will Spanish language voting materials get you to the polls? If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Mark Thomas, let's start with you first. What are the requirements under the Voting Rights Act? What does that federal mandate say when it comes to accommodating bilingual voters?
Well, it's the Voting Rights Act from 1975, and it's under Section 203. And what it says is once you reach a certain threshold of having citizens over a certain population, so in this case we have the Hispanic population has reached that threshold, and that 5% of the voting age citizens are limited in their English, voting information be provided in that language. So in this case, Salt Lake County has met both of those thresholds and has the requirement to provide election information in Spanish.
Okay. Sherry Swenson, you found out about this when the new census data came out in October. Did it surprise you at all?
We did not know if we would be impacted. We thought it may happen, but we were notified on October 20th by the Department of Justice that we were under the provision of Section 203 of the Voting Rights Act. And so we started very quickly to move toward implementing this according to the federal law.
So it kind of came out of the blue?
Well, they were supposed to release the information in July and then again in September, the census data that is, and then it didn't get finished until October. So it was pretty much a sudden notification. And what we didn't know is that it was supposed to pertain as much as possible to the November 8th election.
So you have roughly 2 weeks to get ready.
Yes.
So how did your office scramble to make that happen? And what were you able to accomplish before this November's election?
We had our voting rights poster translated into Spanish, our voting machine instructions. We were able to get the pages on my county website translated. It was too late to do anything with the paper ballots or even the electronic voting machine ballots because they were all locked down and, you know, being delivered to the polling locations. So we did as much as we could.
Mm. How many Spanish-speaking voters are there in Salt Lake County? Mark Thomas, do you know?
You know, I don't know, and I don't know if they necessarily tell you from the census.
Sherry Swenson?
I don't know exactly. What they did is notified us that there were pockets throughout the county of non-proficient English-speaking individuals. And so based on that American census survey that they send out, they take into consideration, it isn't the entire county, but they look at areas, jurisdictions within the county, and if any of those jurisdictions meet that criteria, then we as a county become under Section 203 of the Voting Rights Act.
So do you have to provide bilingual services to just those neighborhoods where the Spanish speakers are clustered, or is it a countywide? You've got so many people in the county, you need to do this countywide.
All of the election-related material needs to be printed in both languages, like our voter registration forms, our vote-by-mail application, provisional envelopes, anything printed needs to be countywide. However, going into next year's elections, the bilingual poll workers will be stationed according to those areas that are identified.
We're speaking with Salt Lake County Clerk Sherry Swenson, who is in charge of elections for Salt Lake County. Also with us, Mark Thomas, Director of Elections for the State of Utah. If you'd like to join us, we're talking about bilingual ballots in Salt Lake County. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Mark Thomas, is Salt Lake County unique in the state in that it has met a threshold and has to abide by the Voting Rights Act?
Well, no, they're not. San Juan County is also under this provision. In fact, they've been under this provision since 1975, when the Voting Rights Act was first initiated. So they have to provide election information for the Navajo language. And for the most part, it's not a written language, so they do have some special provisions in the statute to allow for a language that's not written. And so, but they've been doing that for years, and so, but it is new to Salt Lake this go around.
And are there other counties that are approaching that threshold in the state for Spanish speakers?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. 801-355-TALK is our number. So, Sherry Swenson, you mentioned the accommodations you're making, Spanish on the website, voter information, ballots, other measures that are maybe a little bit tricky for you to provide to the Spanish-speaking voters in the county?
Well, we'll try to determine. We do have the electronic voting machines, which accommodates many various types of languages, so that's a good thing. They will be very helpful. People going to the polls or early voting locations will have an opportunity to select which language. I mean, it's very clear cut. It's just a simple, you know, select on the screen which language you want your ballot in.
Like going to the ATM.
Right.
Right.
That's very easy to accommodate, and we're lucky that we have that electronic voting machine to accommodate this. As far as the printed ballots, we're going to have to determine how we're going to handle that. We'll have a very large ballot next year for the general election, and so we may, instead of going to a two-page ballot, both sides no less, we'll probably determine which of those jurisdictions will need to have Spanish ballots provided so that it won't be necessarily county-wide.
Hmm. Elections, of course, depend on a huge pool of volunteers to help you out at the polls. How hard is it going to be to find Spanish-speaking poll workers? Do you have enough right now?
We don't know. We're going to reach out, and we've already met with some of the community leaders. We're going to be reaching out and trying to determine where we need the bilingual poll workers. And hopefully we can get volunteers that will help us with that. We just sent out a poll worker survey for our last election, and one of the questions we asked is, are you bilingual and do you speak fluent Spanish? So that hopefully we can garner from that group of people who have already served as poll workers.
So how many do you have in that little select group already?
They haven't responded. We just sent the survey out the other day, but we'll be finding out.
Salt Lake County Clerk Sherry Swenson, have you had specific needs crop up in recent elections? Somebody at a poll who says, I've got a voter who needs a translator or a request for some assistance on the ballot.
One of the things we did for this past election, the November 8th election, was to notify at a poll manager briefing that if someone needs assistance, they definitely have people in our office they can call. And we have a help desk, and they were instructed to have them call, and we were able to help a couple of voters for this last election translate by having someone on staff.
Mark Thomas, you said that the Department of Justice is the one who kind of is the heavy in this, and they notified you about this particular mandate. What happens if they're not satisfied with all of the measures that Salt Lake County or other counties who are facing this requirement, what happens to them? Is it a fee? Is it a fine? Is it a lawsuit? What is it?
It's probably worse than all of those. They come in and they will decide what is best for Salt Lake County, and they will probably do that by way of a lawsuit. But that the does take away some discretion from Salt Lake County doing what they think is best for the people of Salt Lake County. And so it's always better for Salt Lake County to decide that rather than the Department of Justice.
Salt Lake County, clearly not the first county to encounter this requirement. Sherry Swenson, where are you looking? You know, what cities, what counties are you looking to who have done these implementations, and what kinds of guidance are you getting from outside of Utah?
Well, one of the first things I did was to contact my former election director, is now the assistant election director in San Diego County, and they now have four languages that they're required to place on the ballot in addition to English. And
wow.
So they have a vast amount of experience. They're a much larger county, but they were also a jurisdiction that was put under an agreement by the Department of Justice because whatever they did in the past wasn't satisfactory.
Mm.
So I immediately looked to them, and they sent me a lot of information, some plans that they had implemented, how to accommodate this and how to do it so that we don't end up in that situation. My current election director is also from San Bernardino County. He's worked in San Bernardino, where they were under that provision of Section 203 as well. So he has experience. And there's a lot of information on the Department of Justice website. There's a number of cases that you can study and see, you know, what was done in those situations where they didn't feel it was done adequately.
Have you had any kickback from anybody who says, look, we're in America. We should not be providing ballots in a language other than the official language of English? Sherry Swenson?
Well, I've had two phone calls plus an email. There have been a lot of comments on the media stories about it. And basically, you know, it's a federal law that Congress first implemented in 1975. They renewed it again in 1982, 1992, and again in 2006. And this current provision will go through 2031. And so, you know, their reasons for doing it, obviously, they've studied the situation. And, you know, so, yes, we've had some comments. One of the comments I get quite often is I thought they had to speak English in order to become citizens. Well, in some cases, especially if they were naturalized many years ago, that wasn't necessarily true. And it's not about just speaking English, it's being English proficient. As you know, some of the constitutional amendments and the propositions are hard for even we who speak English to totally understand. So although they may have limited English skills, they aren't necessarily proficient in order to become citizens.
That is true. Ballot language can be a little perplexing at times. Mark Thomas, have you been getting feedback at your office about, you know, hey, we should be only printing in English?
Yes, we have. From our office and also from the governor's office has received a few comments from folks. And one of the things that I'll add on to what Sherry said that we've heard is the English only. Years ago, there was an initiative that passed and made its way through the courts, and it was the English-only act that it declared English as the official language of Utah. But in that statute, though, it does specifically say that if federal law requires you to print something in a language other than English, then you can do that. So there is that carve out in the statute that allows for this to happen. And clearly this is a federal law that is put down on to San Juan County and to Salt Lake County.
We've only got about a minute left. Sherry Swenson, the bottom line, how much is this going to cost the county to implement these changes to provide bilingual ballots and services?
You know, at this point in time, we're always reassessing and redoing our forms for the future elections. And so, you know, we're going to try to do it as efficiently as we can by doing a bilingual form in the case of voter registration and, you know, provisional envelopes, vote by mail applications. So, you know, I don't think there'll be a large cost in that because we'd be reprinting forms anyway. We even have a new political party, so we would have to reprint all of our voter registration forms to add that. As far as the ballots, we already have the electronic voting machine with that capability. So I don't see it being a huge cost. You know, we haven't really got an estimate, but it will be some. But I'm thinking it will probably be maybe in the range of 10,000 to 20,000 maximum. One of the things is the public notice in Spanish, you know, and that may be a little costly for us.
But just very quickly, if I'm an English-speaking voter, is the bilingual ballot going to affect my voting experience at all?
No. No, it really won't. I had an email from someone who was upset that they were going to have to wade through, you know, the Spanish ballot, but that won't be the case. It's a simple selection on the voting screen as to which language.
Salt Lake County Clerk Sherry Swenson, thanks very much for your time.
You're welcome.
Also, Mark Thomas, Director of Elections for the State of Utah. And Mark, thanks to you.
Thanks.
City Views is a production of KCPW News. Jesse Ellis is our technical director. Ryan Cron composed our theme music. You can continue the discussion online at kcpw.org. Next time, pseudonyms and getting published, how the Mike Winder, Richard Burwash episode is affecting newsrooms and West Valley's image. That's coming up tomorrow. For City Views, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce.